The following may contain offensive language, adult humor, and or content that some viewers may find offensive. The views and opinions expressed by any one speaker does not explicitly or necessarily reflect or represent those of Mark Rattledge or W2M Network. Please listen with caution, or don't listen at all.
TV party tonight!
About anything else.
We don't want to know.
We're dedicated, yes,
to our favorite shows.
All my tickets.
Everybody loves Hypnoto.
Scary Dog.
Larson at Blurnsville.
Futurama.
Good evening. You are listening to a Rattledge Broadcasting premiere podcast TV party tonight. I'm your host, Magic Mock. No, I'm your host, the Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. And tonight, our favorite show is Winning Time, The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty Season 2, brought to you by the good people at HBO Entertainment, Steeplechase Amusements, Jim Heck Productions, Hyper Object Industries, and Jason Schumann Productions. Winning Time, The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty is an American sports drama, a television series created by Max Borenstein and Jim Heck for HBO, based on the book Showtime, Magic, Kareem, Riley, and the Los Angeles Lakers Dynasty in the 1980s by Jeff Perlman. The first season, which myself and Jason Teasley reviewed last year, comprised of 10 episodes and focused on the Showtime era of the Los Angeles Lakers. It features an ensemble cast of John C. Riley, Jason Clark, Jason Siegel, Gabby Hoffman, Rob Morgan, and Adrian Brody. The second season takes place between 1980 and 1984 and focuses mainly on the rivalry between
Does not explicitly or necessarily reflect or represent those of Mark Rattledge or W2M Network. Please listen with caution or don't listen at all.
Weird. Don't know how that happened. Sorry about that. Focused on the rivalry between the LA Lakers and the Boston Celtics. And here to pull me out of the morass I just stepped into is the one and only Pat Not Riley Mullen. How do you do, sir?
Good evening, Mark, and good evening, everybody. I'd like to remind you to please listen with caution or don't listen at all if you didn't hear that the second time.
We're going to play it every 2 minutes just in case people don't get it. So Jason and I, as I said, reviewed the first season of this, and it was one of these deals where it was a show. It was an Adam McKay show. Adam McKay, I mentioned this earlier when I was speaking with Sean about the Red Curtain trilogy. He's the one that brought us Don't Look Up. He's also done Vice and some other, interesting movies. And he definitely has a very, distinct style, a very frenetic sort of ADD riddled style of direction. So I was interested in this. I also grew up during the Showtime era. I told Jason at the time I played the old Magic versus Larry video game for the Commodore 64. But since sports were not a thing in my house, I did not watch much basketball. It's one of those cultural things where nobody could get away from the Lakers-Celtics thing. You know, Lakers stuff was everywhere in the years of our Lord, 80 through 84. And, you know, I was 4 through 8. So I'm aware of what was going on, but I did not have detail. So I was interested in this show, and as was Jason. Jason, as we talked about in the White Man Can't Jump show, is a big basketball fan, basketball player. And then he bailed out on me on the second season. I was like, hey, they did a second season of this. Are you interested? He's like, I'm not really motivated. And I'm like, well, if you're not motivated, then we're not doing this. And from the bench comes Pat Mullen, ready to dunk the basketball after Jason decided to retire. Why are you here, Pat? Why did you decide to pick up the ball and run with it, as it were?
You know, I love the show. I think it was a lot of fun. And as somebody who is a big Boston Celtics fan, very big into the Magic Bird rivalry years of that era, the later rivalry years that we had in 08 to 10, this was a very fun look, and I liked that it was shot from the Laker perspective initially, and this season was definitely more of a Tale of Two Cities type, where you had a lot of the story of the Lakers and their ongoing, you know, internal and external difficulties from that 1980 to 84 period. And it's not so much the team of the Celtics as it is very focused on Larry Bird as their emerging superstar of that time and the counterpart to Magic. And with some featuring of Red Auerbach, played by Michael Chiklis, which I also loved.
Oh, is that who that was? Michael Chiklis in a fat suit?
That was Michael Chiklis.
What a performance. Yeah. I didn't even realize it was him. Yeah.
Also a Bostonian, so probably a lot of fun for him.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they gave him scale. Like, he was just like, yeah, I don't care. You can pay me in hot dogs. I can't wait to play this role. Good for him. I really like this. I'm mixed about it being over. It was canceled after two seasons, and season two was abbreviated. It's only 7 episodes. It ends with the Lakers losing the 1984 NBA Finals to the Boston Celtics. But then in the cards at the end, it talks about, you know, the Lakers won 2 out of 3 NBA Finals against Boston, and that the Magic Larry Bird rivalry pretty much saved basketball. Like, it was, they were the four kings of basketball in that era. And I think that's interesting. I also, and so on the one hand, I'm sad that it's over because I really like the show and I like the players. On the other hand, other than getting into the nitty gritty of basketball history, I'm not entirely sure where they could have gone with this. So I'm not, like I said, my feelings about it are mixed.
My speculation is they got word early that they were not going to get any more than a second season.
Mm-hmm.
And so during production, they probably decided, oh shit, we have to tell the whole story as much as we can.
Yeah.
Through that period. And you get a very, very, like you said, that frenetic style of an Adam McKay production, where you're jumping year to year to year very quickly, because the show's 7 episodes covering a very tumultuous 4-year period.
Yeah, to kind of, and we're going to talk about some very specific things, but if you're kind of listening just because you enjoy the show and you want to, and you don't really know anything about Winning Time or about Lakers basketball, it continues from where the Jason Segel character left off, where he kind of comes off the bench and replaces their coach. And he's an academic and somebody who really has to prove himself. And he's sort of a thinking man's basketball coach. And he earns his respect. He wins an NBA title. But then, as many intellectuals tend to sort of put themselves in a bubble and decide, well, I'm the smartest guy in the room. I know what's best. And he's up against an owner who is trying to make this a business. And, you know, I can't fault him for that. And it's just like, what is best for business here? That's really all I'm interested in. And a 20-year-old million-dollar playing basketball athlete who throws tantrums like a petulant child because his job isn't fun anymore. It goes from that to the transition to Pat Riley taking over the team, who, by the way, and I kind of have to pick at you for this. So you're like, oh, I'm a big Boston fan. Motherfucker, you from New York. Knicks. Pat Riley and the Knicks. Come on now.
Listen. If it wasn't for Isaiah Thomas and Dolan trying to destroy their fan base actively, I'd still be a Knicks fan. I grew up a Knicks fan.
Okay.
But then they did, the front office and coaching staff decided, we hate our fans. We're going to deliberately tank this team year after year and charge you exorbitant prices to go to games to see this team go 18-50. And at that point, I was like, you know what? No, we're not going to do this. And my favorite active player was Ray Allen. Ray Allen played for the Boston Celtics, and here we are.
I was paying somewhat attention to the Knicks back in high school because my best friend Tom was a big Knicks fan, and you know, Patrick Ewing was the toast of the town at the time, and Pat Riley was the coach, if I remember correctly.
Yes, he was.
And I remember it was either a playoff game or it might have been the finals where the Knicks were taking on, I believe, the San Antonio Spurs, and they lost, and my friend had to get up and leave the house and go for a run because he was so mad, Pat. He was so mad.
And that was 1999.
No doubt. So anyway, back to 1984. So yeah, we get the transition of Pat Riley taking over the team. The season deals a lot with the ups and downs of Magic Johnson, who gets the single biggest athletic contract in the history of sports, like 25 years, $1 million a year. And the effect that that has on the league, the effect that has on the players, the effect it has on his treatment therein. It focuses a lot on Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and him kind of you know, his last years on the team and what he's going to do with them, and his sort of frustrations with John C. Reilly's character, and Magic to a lesser extent. But it also focuses a lot on Larry Bird. And I kind of want to start there because I think because as much as this focuses on Dr. Bussey and Magic and the Lakers, there's a really fascinating story here about Larry Bird. And I have so many questions. But before we get into that, we talked about like why this is only two seasons long, and it's abbreviated. This show is riddled with controversy. And the controversy is the people being portrayed are all objecting to their portrayals, saying like this is not how it went.
Not all of them, but a good amount of them.
Yeah, this apparently pissed a lot of people off. Why don't you tell me about that, Pat? There's a few people wildly objecting to their portrayals in this show and threatening to, and I quote, take it to the Supreme Court, which it doesn't work that way, but sure.
Yeah, that would be Jerry West that you're referring to. Mm-hmm. Who is played by Jason Clarke in this show. And Jerry is basically portrayed as a foul-mouthed, explosive, deadpan serious at all times, mm-hmm. win at any cost type of attitude. And you know what? Jerry was a fierce competitor in his day. Mm-hmm. Jerry, despite being league MVP, not getting more than that one championship, really did get mad about that for the rest of his career. However, Jerry's also a very smart businessman. He is not as foul-mouthed or ill-tempered as you see in the show. But to HBO's credit, they have always said, we are not presenting this as a documentary. We are sensationalizing some things and some personalities involved. So that's one. But then on the flip side, you have a guy like Spencer Hayward, where they documented that Hayward was massively addicted to cocaine during his playing time for the Lakers, to the point where during the playoffs, when they're making their championship run, he's ejected from the team for his problems. Mm-hmm. And Hayward said, you know what? That show treated me and my problems really well. I was very happy with how I was depicted.
Mm-hmm.
But then, again, aside from Jerry West, we have Magic and Kareem, neither of whom is happy with their portrayal. And, you know, I get that. But Magic himself has gone on record and talked about his behavior in the past at times and what it was. And Kareem was not ever really known as a nice guy to anybody until well after his retirement. And even now, I'm not a big fan of Kareem personally. Professionally, I think he's one of the very best. But the actual man, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, not my cup of tea.
That's fair.
And a lot of the portrayal in this show is not that off base with that, and that's why.
Yeah, Magic Johnson, drawing from Robert Winfrey, complaining about the inaccuracies of the show, having never watched it. And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar said it was deliberately dishonest. To which I say to both of them, it's a not fictionalized, but dramatized. For entertainment purposes. And I don't know if you know of this phrase, because you may be from Belarus, like many people I know, where they don't have culture. But there's something called creative license. And you use that to add dramatic things to your drama so that it's more entertaining, because this is not a dry recitation of events. It's not a documentary. And even documentaries sauce things up a bit, you know, because people have to sit and watch this stuff. So my personal take, and you can respond to this and then we can get into Larry, is Jerry West, Magic especially, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, a lot of whining. I'm sorry the entertaining show on HBO didn't paint you as the kings of industry that you think you are, you gods among men, but I don't know, take a Xanax and calm the fuck down. It's a television show.
Although to be fair, I found Jerry West to be one of the most entertaining parts of the show. I thought Jason Clarke just going off on expletive filled rants about stuff was great.
Oh my God. I've never seen somebody use the word fuck the way, you know, more than I do.
He works in fuck the way artists work in acrylics. Like, it's incredible.
Yeah, it's like that scene from the first season of The Wire, but writ large. It's like, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
What is wrong with Larry Bird? So there's an entire episode of this where they have to send the owner of the Boston Celtics to go, like, bring him back. He's dealing with his dad. There's stuff with his mom. It almost seems like he's not going to come back to the Celtics. Larry Bird, as portrayed in this show, played like he had the world's biggest chip on his shoulders. They give him, the last two episodes, they give him some fantastic lines. Like, we need 12 heart transplants. you know, and if we play like this, we deserve to lose. You know, the dirty basketball scenes where they're roughing up the Lakers and getting one over on them. It's great stuff. It's great drama. If you're into sports drama, that's good shit right there. But Larry, there's a scene between him and his mom that I really liked. And I do want you to speak to, you know, the man and then the character. But the way he's portrayed, Larry plays like he's angry at the game, you know, like, or he's angry at the world and he's taking it out on basketball. And he says something to his mom and the mom goes, you used to be happy playing. And I wish you had something along the lines of, I wish you had joy playing again. And, you know, he kind of smiles at her and almost like in the performance, like I'll look and see who's playing Larry Bird in this, but in the performance there's almost like that tacit recognition of I may have let this thing beat me and I might need to come back from the brink. On the other hand, because he's so angry and he's so sour and he's willing to win at any cost, he picks that team up and they get wins where there were losses from the Lakers. And it's really cool to watch.
Yeah, you know, Larry in real life did have a chip on his shoulder and Larry was mad at the world. Larry's dad was an abusive alcoholic and they were very, very poor from a poor town called French Lick, Indiana, where, you know, he just his only outlet really for anything was basketball at the time. And Larry.
Yeah, worked. I think I remember one of my college professors telling me that the way Larry learned to play basketball was to take his anger, put it into a piece of paper, crumple up the piece of paper and throw it in a basket. And that's how he developed his three pointer.
Yeah. And Larry would play with the only black guys he knew in French Lick, which was largely a hick white town. But Larry, a lot of the staff at the hotel restaurant that Larry got a job at, they all played basketball and the majority of them were black and he would play with them because he was learning to play the game from guys who were better than just a random, you know, hick white kid with a basketball and a garbage can to play in. And Larry,
it's funny to hear you say that because at some point he says the line, give me the rock. And I went, no, you wouldn't say give me the rock. And apparently he would.
Well, and here's the thing. Larry's known as one of the best trash talkers in the history of the NBA, where multiple guys have repeated the story where if you put a white guard on Larry, he was pissed off, would immediately drop a three right on them, run over to the bench and tell the coach, don't you ever disrespect me like that again. You better get a brother on me.
Oh, he's quickly becoming my hero.
And he was dead serious about it. And there are guys like Charles Barkley and guys from that era who will tell these Larry stories and they are verbatim. That's the way Larry was. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's funny because Larry is such a competitor. And if this show piqued your interest and you enjoyed it, then I recommend following it up with the documentary Magic and Bird, A Courtship of Rivals, that was also produced by HBO some years back. And there's a great story there that I wish they would have depicted this in the show. I understand why they couldn't, but Larry and Magic both signed deals with Converse Shoes in 1983 or 84, and they shot a commercial together where they were playing on the court that Larry played in French Lick, Indiana, in this small town. They were just playing a game of one-on-one, and it's a big production. So there's this whole big catered lunch and everything, and they're right outside Larry's old, you know, childhood house that his mom still lived in. And, you know, they go to eat a catered lunch, and Larry looks at him. He goes, hey, Irvin, no, come on. My mom made us sandwiches. And Magic, who had known only the fierce competitor, Larry Bird, was like, huh, okay. Like, and he talks about how him and Larry just had a nice time with his mom, who was a sweetheart, and they just, you know, got to know each other a little bit. And then, you know, the season starts, and it's their first game against each other, and Magic walks up to him like they're buddies. Hey, Larry. And Larry just goes, get the fuck away from me.
Game time.
Because it was all business at game time. So that kind of fierce competitor attitude that they show in Bird, that's pretty much the real deal, Larry.
Do they still make athletes like Larry Bird?
Society doesn't want us to.
That's a whole other
Larry TikTok. Would be considered toxically masculine by people we call stupid.
Yep, that's a whole other TikTok there, pal. So keeping with talking about the show, what did you think of Larry's portrayal in the show? And I'm going to quick pull the actor's name.
I think it's, for the most part, pretty fair. You know,
Sean Patrick Small, who does not have a hyperlink.
Well, I think they cast him more than anything for the look, because he does look a good bit like Larry. And again, if you're filming this with as much basketball as they show in this, you have to have some competency with handling a basketball, shooting a basketball, and looking like an athlete. Mm-hmm. And Larry specifically is a hard one to portray, because Larry did a lot of things that didn't look very athletic in his time, but it was his hard way of playing the game that made him so elite and is still looked at as one of the greatest of all time.
My favorite bit, because again, if you don't like the Adam McKay style, and I need to just quick tell people, because if you don't know what Adam McKay style is, he tends to do a lot of panning to the camera, and not necessarily a character, but the things like putting up words on the screen that tell the audience, yes, this really happened. No, this didn't really happen. This is an exaggeration. Here's the recipe for pie. Something along those lines. Like, there's always like a breaking of the fourth wall that Adam McKay does. He also changes filters on the lens. He shows different perspectives through different like filming techniques. Again, it's very frenetic, but it's not like Baz Luhrmann busy. It's more like you sometimes can't tell if you're watching a dramatization or a documentary or like, you know, ancient film, because he keeps changing lens filters.
to
show different things. And so it's a very busy show in that respect. But it tends to work more often than not with Adam McKay. And there's a great scene with Larry Bird that I just adore. And I want you to react to this. So I guess he went back. He was thinking about going back to college or something like that, where he was at Indiana. And
he was at the University of Indiana and left.
Right. And so he goes back and he's in jeans and a flannel, looking like right out of a Seattle rock band. And he has an exchange with the coach. He's like, all right, I'll play. And he's like, do you need to get shorts or anything? He was like, no, I'm fine. And then the words come up. It's like, he really did play in his jeans. And he kicks everybody's ass. Look, you know, we made the quip about toxic masculinity, but when men act like men, you know, and there's no bullshit, and there's just like, I don't need to get shorts. I'm here to kick ass and chew bubble gum, and I am all out of bubble gum. And he whoops these kids' ass in jeans. That's awesome.
Yeah, and that's how it went. Larry left the University of Indiana, a very high profile program school, a lot of students. He didn't feel right there. Larry had a ton of social anxiety and just couldn't adjust to life there. Where he goes is the much smaller Indiana State, which is not known as any type of powerhouse program or anything like that. And he's being recruited to come back to play ball because the coach there knows he's a special talent. So they're trying to get him. And when he finally does show up in jeans, a flannel, you know, work boots, you know, ostensibly, and goes in there and just shows that, hey, I'm one of the most special talents you'll ever see. It's awesome. And I love that there's certain things in the Legend of Magic that I wish they would have put in. There's certain things in the Legend of Larry I wish they would have put in. But like them including that, I think it's an important piece to show you the difference in this Showtime variety that we're getting from Magic and everything that surrounded him versus the way Bird broke in and the stuff there, because the dichotomy is so compelling between these two personalities.
It's interesting to watch the portrayal of the way Magic plays. He's so much more limber. He's so much more flexible. The stuff where they're focusing on the system, which is Jason Segel's character basically saying, go to where you're going to hit the most shots from the floor. Go there every time and throw up as many as you can. We will make more buckets than lose by sheer volume. It's kind of, you know, like in boxing. Let's throw as many punches as we can. Most of them will probably land, and you'll at least win the round if you don't knock the guy out. It's the same concept here. Throw up a lot of volume, more baskets will go in than not, and we'll win games, which limited where Magic, you know, Matt, he's called a savant in the show. And, you know, Magic was one of those Jordan, Kobe unique talents where there are different kinds of intelligences in the world, and he was athletically intelligent, especially, obviously, in the game of basketball.
And
when they took that away from him, maybe he could have made something out of it if he had been more mature and maybe even smarter than he was. But instead, he bristled against it and threw a tantrum. And, you know, we can talk about what happens after. Whereas contrast that with the way Larry is portrayed, where Larry can hit a three-pointer from the couch in his home. Like, they were, you know, it's funny. If you told Larry to go to his spot, the court was his spot. He could shoot from fucking anywhere. And it was, well, it was like smooth as silk.
But again, you have a system where the Boston Celtics coaching staff is building a team around Larry at that mm-hmm. point because they know what they have. The Magic's initial approach was, you know, they had Jack McKinney. They drafted Magic to play in a McKinney-type system because the McKinney-type system was one of allowing Magic to not just be have to rely on as being a scorer, but where he could distribute, which yeah. Magic may be the best distributor in the history of the
There's NBA. A lot of – so from a filming technique, and this is a television review, there's a lot of Magic doing this.
Yes. And that's the point, him spreading the floor by spreading the ball mm-hmm. around, which is maybe the strongest aspect of his game. And then you have mm-hmm. Paul Westhoff coming in and implementing this system, which is going to restrict Magic's ability to do a lot of what he was initially brought in to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Magic getting tight about it, saying, hey, this is limiting my game and my ability to contribute. And they dramatized this too, obviously, where, you know, they, you know, Magic didn't vocally go out there the way they have him in the show doing it. Mm-hmm. However, he was the most vocal criticizer of Paul Westhoff and the system. But in reality, the rest of the team was on the same side as him. They just weren't as vocal about it.
That's fair. I mean, and we can, unless you have anything more to say about Larry and his portrayal in the show, I think there's something to be said for in real life. You might bristle and you might be grumpy about your coach, but you're soldiers and you follow your orders. And I most teams operate that way. You know, it gets dicey, especially as players become personalities, because then the press wants to talk to them, and some of them don't know when to stop talking. Some of them don't know how to keep their foot out of their mouth, and some of them don't care. Some of them will absolutely just tell you how they feel about something and will absolutely throw their coach under the bus. So I thought that was an interesting way of handling the show. Even if it's not accurate, I don't care as much. I think the idea of sort of Magic feeling like, I was just given a $25 million contract, my opinion matters. His the scene of him confronting John C. Reilly, I think, is one of the best in the show, where he basically, you know, it's like, you're my partner, you're like a son to me. And he was like, and I wouldn't be here if I couldn't play basketball. Can we not, you know, like, I'm willing to go. It's funny. To quote a line from The Deuce, which we just reviewed earlier in the week, you play your part as pimp and I play part as prostitute, you know, and I'm willing to do the pretend. But, you know, once the pretending is over, we're done here. Paraphrasing. And that's kind of where Magic was coming from. He was like, I'm willing to pretend with you that I matter, but as soon as I can't play basketball, you're gonna throw me out of my fucking ass. So for now, you know, so if I'm that valuable, then maybe try listening and hold on to me and either get rid of this coach or get him to change how he's treating me, because this isn't working.
Which is funny, because Magic ends up the complete opposite, where they bring him into the front office and he becomes GM of the team and, you know, everything that goes on after that. But in
he also had like the Bret Hart, like, million-year contract where he wasn't going to play forever.
Yeah. But it's also a great scene in that respect, because mm-hmm. for as much as they portray Magic at times as immature or, you know, still very adolescent in his behaviors, mm-hmm. that's as adult a thing as you see him do, where in no way is he in the wrong with how he speaks to Dr. Buss.
Yeah.
And it was awesome to see from a character standpoint. And I think Magic as a character in the show and the narrative needed that moment to happen so that people would still, people would still side with him in a certain respect. Whereas, you know, at a certain point, you're going to villainize him if he just is this guy throwing tantrums and wanting it to be about me, me, me.
Right.
Instead, he goes with a very logical point to this owner about his treatment, the future of the team and everything involved, where it's rationalized and thought out and is a really fair portrayal, I feel, of how mm-hmm. Magic handled things at that time. And they went with it, and it results in one of the best scenes in the show. And they allow, my gosh, I forget the fellow playing Magic, but he's great. They allow him to really carry that scene. And all John C. Reilly really has to do is just give those facial reactions, which he does a great job with, and it plays so well.
Quincy Isaiah, by the way.
Quincy Isaiah, who's great.
Yeah, he has he does a lot of acting with his eyes, which I think is really good. And he was clearly, just like the guy who plays Larry Bird, clearly selected for his body type.
I was going to say physical resemblance, yeah.
Yeah. but he does an excellent, I mean, he carries a lot of the show on his shoulders. I mean, it's not all John C. Reilly and Adrian Broner, I'll tell you that much. I do want to talk about the portrayal of Jason Segel's character, Paul Westhead. So, I think it's interesting. I think it's sort of a examination of maybe somebody getting to. There's two ways to look at Westhead, and I'm not entirely sure which way how I feel. Because on the one hand, there's the argument that he got too big for his britches, that his need for control, as what happens to the best of us, overwhelms him. And it's funny, when he finally does get fired, you know, after treating Pat Riley, played by Adrian Broner, Adrian Brody, as badly as he does, then does that thing. Why didn't you stop me? And Brody just looks at him like, what the fuck? Like, I've been trying to stop you. You choose to not listen at all. But, you know, you're an intelligent guy, Pat. In fact, my girlfriend thinks you're one of the best guys on this network because you're so smart. She loves listening to us talk because you're brilliant. And as is Robert and some of the other guys here.
That's a dramatization right there, but go on.
Oh, stop it. Take the compliment and smile. But the frustrating thing for brilliant people is nobody listens to us because sometimes our ideas are so far ahead of everyone else, you know, or so out of the box, it makes everyone uncomfortable, and people like familiar, people like comfortable, people don't like change. And so there's an argument to be made of they should have stuck with him and let him do his thing. But then Magic's argument may have had validity too. He was like, this system is too restrictive, and we're barely getting by against teams we should dominate, and we're losing to teams that we should beat. And maybe if you just let us play our game and not this ridiculous system, we would do better. And I think the show, the brilliance of the writing of the show and that in that particular subplot is it leaves it open to audience interpretation. It doesn't really come down hard on who was right and who was wrong there.
You know, and in the reality of things, like Butts has gone on record saying, like, he, even before Magic really made a very strong plea to him in the office meeting, he had already decided to fire Westhead. And Westhead got fired 13 games into that 81-82 season. Mm-hmm. You know, and Paul's tenure as a coach, Paul took over the Jack McKinney system that they established and modified it to what he thought would result in the best possible scoring system for them. With that, he also had Pat Riley as an assistant on with him, whereas Pat, who had a great basketball mind, was an excellent player, but was also more the personnel guy in a lot of respects, as portrayed in the show, where he was the one keeping the relationships with the players going. And as a result, wound up building a lot more respect with them than did Westhead, who at the time is portrayed as having his head up his ass because he's so successful with the system by winning a championship when nobody believed in him and he had to basically fight to keep his job just as an interim head coach.
Right.
With the departure of McKinney. History, unfortunately, will show you that in the NBA, his system didn't work. He leaves LA and goes to the Bulls and just does not do well there. Ends up with like a 33% win percentage with the Bulls. He makes his name again in college where he had been before, where he had started at LaSalle. He went to Loyola Marymount and really turned them into a powerhouse school, led the NCAAs in scoring in like three seasons, I think, in a row in the late 80s. He tried again in the NBA, went to the Nuggets, and they would call them the Enver Nuggets, as in they had no D. Even though the teams would score 119 points, they'd give up 130. And so he just couldn't make that system work in the NBA. He mm-hmm. made it work in the WNBA later on, where he took the Phoenix franchise. I don't remember their name in it, but mm-hmm. he took the Phoenix franchise to their only championship, and he had a three-year span as a head coach there. But Paul is going to be a guy who's largely remembered for taking the broken remnants of, you know, what was left behind and making one championship run out of them, and then getting run out of LA essentially because he refused to allow guys to play their game. They had to play his version of the game. Kind of almost in that John Wooden type of mold.
Do you think the show was fair to Westhead?
I think they were a little bit more negative on him than they needed to be, but I think they needed that for the narrative. You know, and that even goes into his portrayal in season one, where he's very, very, you know, anxious and on edge the whole time and unsure of himself. And in this season, it's very much a 180 where he's won a championship. He knows everything. You can't question him. He doesn't need Pat to make any decisions for him. I'm the coach. This is my team. And is just frequently clashing with everybody. And then you get those scenes where, you know, Jerry and the other assistant GM is meeting without him. Mm-hmm. And he's asking them, well, what's going on? No, don't worry about it. We're fine. And then he hears all the rumors of, are they recruiting this guy to coach? Are they recruiting that guy to coach type of stuff? And then he slips right back into that insecure guy from season one, even with his heartfelt plea to Buss about why he should stay. And Jerry's telling him, you got to go.
Jason Segel's on my short list of actors who, it's not that they can't act, and that's where I'm going with this. Jason Segel's obviously a very good actor. I don't think he takes good parts. I don't think he gets good material, and I think he gets a little lazy. I don't think a lot is asked of him, but I think Jason Segel does a really good job with this character. He's one of the more interesting. It's one of the more interesting performances in the show this season. There's stuff I watch, and that, you know, and as I've talked about with Jesse, because we do a lot of TV together. There are things where, even with the David Simon shows, where I'm just like, I don't care about this. Oh my God, it's another bubble scene. Fast forward, fast forward, fast forward. I know, sacrilege for people watch The Wire. There were just some subplots, some characters, some things I'm just not interested in. But every time he was on screen, I was kind of mesmerized by his performance. What did you think of Jason Segel in this?
I think he was great because they asked him to encompass such a range of personality and emotion during that time. And for him to do it and do it competently all over, I think it says a lot about his ability as an actor. I think your assessment is very fair in that he doesn't get parts that allow him to shine the way he can shine when given the right material. And I think this is really indicative of how good he can be when given the opportunity.
Anything about the portrayal of the Lakers, any particular players that you want to talk about? Because if not, we're going to get into the John C. Reilly stuff.
They kind of weren't fair to Norm Nixon. I'll say that. They made Norm much more of an outright malcontent and stuff. Norm never went out publicly and talked bad about Magic. That wasn't a thing. Mm-hmm. The only legit animosity they had was just that professional animosity of one-upsmanship because they were sharing the backcourt, like what happens where each guy wants to be the best, so they're pushing each other that way.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But it wasn't a contentious thing or a lot of animosity. They didn't tell him they were trading him on his birthday. It was close to his birthday, but it didn't happen. And they even threw a farewell like slash birthday party for him when that happened. There's one other instance that I wanted to bring up. Let me grab my notes real quick. Yes, I actually made notes for this. Aren't you impressed?
Make sure you don't do that anymore. But I tell you, I told the story on a different podcast, but so I've been sending my girlfriend twice. She's very familiar with you. All my podcasts so that we have stuff to talk about because I don't want to talk about bullshit. I don't want to talk about the stuff I talk about here. So I get her to listen to the podcast and she gives me feedback and we talk about it. And she listened to one from the Grammarly Amazon Music era. And she goes, hey, you and your friends are brilliant. And some of you guys make Magic together and you guys really there's a lot of food for thought, grist for the mill. These are very entertaining shows and who to thunk it, you know, based on what you're telling me your podcast is about. Cause I don't watch half of this shit. Can you get someone else to read your fucking ads? You're terrible. it's cause I didn't want to do it. I very much read those with a gun to my head.
Yeah. Well, it was the challenge trade that I was talking about where he, you know, in the show is freaking out. Oh, how can you have traded me? Blah, blah, blah. He really didn't mind it. He went because he was from Cleveland. And so he was actually happy to go closer to home. He didn't like living in LA. He didn't like the lifestyle. And he actually didn't like the play style of the Lakers and felt like he didn't fit there. So it was kind of a win-win for everybody when he was traded.
Okay. I like the way they portrayed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He's much more sympathetic this season than he was last season. Last season, because he's trying to Big Daddy Magic. And Magic, you know, at least the portrayal in the show, which I'm going to keep going back to. I can only judge by the show. I was not aware of the details of real life during this period. But, you know, Magic had a lot of growing up to do real fast to be useful on this era of the Lakers. And then you have Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who's got a chip on his shoulder, but is also intelligent, enlightened, and sees that there's potential in magic if he would only ascend to adulthood. There's less of that this season because magic has made some growth. And so Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is less of a dick and in season two. I kind of like the softer touch Kareem in season two than in season one. I think the actor playing him does a really good job with him. And I brought this up with Maggie Gyllenhaal in both season one and season two of The Deuce. Your ability to play quiet rage, because it's easy to be given a direction on camera, show rage, and you know break furniture and smash things and scream and yell and curse, you know, and you're Jerry West. It's a whole other thing to show rage the way Maggie Gyllenhaal does or the way he does in the show, where you can see him vibrating, but he's calm and even tempered and speaking very matter of factly, but you know he is ready to rip someone's head off Mortal Kombat style. And credit where credit's due, it's a great performance.
Oh, it's a great performance. He mm-hmm. really nails Kareem. Mm-hmm. You know, and probably the standout stuff with Kareem in this season is where he has his house fire.
You read my mind. That yeah. interaction with the kid.
Yeah.
It's great.
Which the house fire really did happen. Kareem really did have a huge like jazz collection of like some very rare vintage stuff mm-hmm. and lost, you know, the majority of it in that fire at his home. And there was a public campaign in LA, like where people were giving records to Kareem to help replace his collection and stuff. And that kind of softened him up to people more mm-hmm. than he had ever been, because Kareem was very militant, very sullen, didn't want to talk to people.
My favorite line in this whole season, I mean, he's talking about his migraine. He's like, you know how I deal with migraines? How, Kareem? I take it out on punk ass white boys.
Yeah.
Oh, Kareem.
Yeah. Which is that's how he was. Kareem mm-hmm. was very much that guy. And yeah. this is, you know, later on in his run, about towards the end of his Laker run. And it's after this, he's going to have his retina injury, but he also shaves his head, mm-hmm. which like is kind of him kind of peeling away a little bit of the onion layer to let people in a little more with them. And he softens up in his career later. This was kind of where the impetus of that came from. But the interaction with the kid, where the kid hands him, you know, the John Coltrane mm-hmm. record, and the kid says, my dad says, and he goes, your father is a wise man. Like, where you can see he doesn't want to, especially because the kid's white, he doesn't want to accept anything from him. And but like, he's got to take, he sees in front of all these people, and he sees this kid just with this act of kindness to him for no other reason than he's just a fan.
Well, it does go back to what Magic said. None of us would be here if we couldn't play ball. And it does make you feel a little, it's a little slavish. It's a little, we're only appreciated for our bodies and, you know, and what we can do athletically. But isn't that also capitalism? You know, where our value is by what we can produce. And so it's a complex thing, because I can see Kareem's point of view of, if I were just a black guy, no one would have any respect for me. I would not be seen, but I can play basketball, and I'm, you know, and I can produce value for rich white people, and so I'm treated with respect, and that's not fair. Uh-huh. That's how most of us are. So to one degree or another, you know, our value is what we can produce and what we can give to other people, not in who we are as people. It's a shitty way to live, but that's the life, that's the society we've built. And I think it's interesting that the writers of the show in their own ways lightly touch on that. And I'm glad it gets brought up. They don't focus on it too much, because they are trying to tell this other story. They are not, this isn't a race gets brought up, but it doesn't, that's not what the show is about. They just could not talk about it.
It's you address the elephant in the room at times, but the elephant isn't the story.
Right.
And okay. I'm glad about that.
Yeah. If you don't have anything else on your notes, we can move on to, cause I got to talk about John C. Reilly and his kids and all of that. So I like John C. Reilly. I think he's a great actor. I think he gives a lot of character to Dr. Buss. I think his relationship with his daughter is sweet. And despite their ups and downs, at least the way he's portrayed in the show, I think he treats her well, better than his sons. And he's a very flawed character, a very flawed person. I thought it was interesting because the last two or three episodes kind of deal with the falling out of his relationship, because he has a business arrangement where he's still married to his first wife, and he's supposed to file for divorce so that he can marry this new woman, and he can't bring himself to do it. And I was like, they don't really go into why, though. That's one of the few criticisms I have of this show, because I think the basketball stuff is handled really, really well. But like, the basketball doesn't leave a lot of unanswered questions. When he's dealing with the business and the basketball stuff, his stuff makes sense. When they start dealing with his like internal psychosis and family turmoil, some of it doesn't make any sense to me. I don't understand what was he hanging on to that he couldn't file for divorce.
So Honey's a pastiche of like three or four different women in Jerry's life at random times. There was controversy at one point because he did marry a second wife while still technically married to his first wife.
That's illegal.
Yes, that would be polygamy. but it wasn't so much, you know, a thing that didn't get flushed out and settled. It didn't dictate a lot of his business or decisions at that point either. It's something they put in there because it happened. And I think they want to have some sense of altruism to this show. But because, one, you're dealing with a shortened season, which I would imagine they were supposed to get a 10-episode order for a season. Instead, HBO saw that the production costs were high. The viewership wasn't what they wanted. They decided, okay, we're going to pull the plug on this. We're only going to do 7 episodes to give you everything to wrap it up. And so maybe they did have more to go into with it. But this season, other than that relationship drama that really went nowhere and didn't have a true structured narrative to it, we really got a lot less Jerry Buss, unless it was really him dealing with Janie. And I think that's one of the fundamental success stories of the show's run, is that relationship between Jerry and Janie over the two seasons.
Sure, and there's very much a making
development,
a making of amends. You know, I can't remember where else I saw this, but you know, the father that goes away to make his fortune and upsets his children along the way and comes back, and I can't remember what now the hell I reviewed with somebody where that was a big part of it, where it was, you know, this father. Oh, it was the Royal Tenenbaums. I discussed that with Sean, where you have the Dabney Coleman character, who, you know, is a ne'er-do-well and a cad, and he's trying to make amends, and Ben Stiller, you know, won't have any of it. And at some point, Dabney Coleman's like, this has not gotten to the point where you're the problem. I am doing everything I possibly can to make amends with you and make things right. And you're being impossible. And that's John C. Reilly's story in the show, where, you know, he is.
Again, it's okay, Gene Bean.
he's brilliant, but he's also terribly flawed and, you know, questionably ethical, to say the least. And he's trying to make amends. And, you know, and so it's like, you know, I mean, Jesus Christ, I can't get my dad to, you know, to just give me money. Instead, he, you know, I have to always pay him back. Meanwhile, he gives fucking Genie a tennis team. You know, he gives, I think, the one kid a hockey team,
a roller derby team, whatever it is. You know,
yeah, he was just like, here, go run. Gosh, I wish somebody would let me run a fucking sports team.
Yeah, giving them everything out of the forum, but he also, to that point, as much of an absentee dad as he is or has been, he seems to understand that the only one of his kids, and at least in the narrative of the show, that's showing any sign of business intelligence and upward potential is Genie.
I'm wondering how much of that is we live in the year of our Lord 2023 and, you know, girls rock and guys stink. So it was like,
Genie really is a brilliant businesswoman. Like that's very accurate. Genie, I mean, for all they want to say about, maybe just a pro female narrative. No, Genie's a genius. There's a reason she took over the Lakers empire and was as successful as she was with it. So I'm not going to throw any shade at Genie Buss. The boys are probably not fairly depicted, his two sons.
That's more of what I was saying. I wasn't detracting her. I'm saying there's so much focus on her because, well, don't we all love a story about a dad and his daughter, you know, a father and his girl. And it isn't as much fun or as much, you know, or as much reflective of current day entertainment value to see a father treat his sons well.
Yeah. And again, and it's not even that he treats them poorly. He just kind of it's like he knows they're idiots. Here, here's
this. Oh my god, no, that Monopoly scene. I'm gonna take you to task there. That Monopoly scene is so written from the point of view of, I wish my parents weren't so mean to me, when mean is step up and be a man and be responsible, fight the hard fights, go to work, and you know, go to work hurt.
You traded my girlfriend?
Yeah, oh my god, it's so great. But I mean, I feel like the writers in that scene wrote that to be, you know, for the audience to be mad at John C. Reilly, where I'm watching this going, I'm on John C. Reilly's side.
Yeah.
Stop being a pussy.
Step up, you know?
Right. But
listen, it's okay. Chain Payne, honey, just took thimble for this game. It's all right.
Pat and his impressions. Outside of that, I think my overall sort of opinion on the show is I'm entertained by it. I like sports dramas. I played a lot of basketball when I was a kid. I didn't play on any teams or anything. I wasn't that good. I'm also, you know, I think either like average height for a guy or just short of that. I'm around 5'8", 5'9". So I wasn't making any basketball teams. But I played a lot of pickup basketball, as I talked about with Jason. The little bit of basketball I have watched, I've always found entertaining. I've gone, since I've lived in Florida, I've gone to a few Magic games, Orlando Magic, and they're always fun to watch. So watching a sports drama about the rise of the Lakers was entertaining for me. It, you know, would I recommend the show? Yeah, absolutely. Just have to know that you're getting a very Adam McKay show, even though he didn't direct any of the season two episodes. He only directed the pilot of season one. Most of these, and I thought this was interesting because I looked it up real quick. Most of the episodes for season two, directed by Sally Richard Whitfield. She's the doctor from Sci-Fi, from Eureka.
She's actually in one of your favorite movies. She's in The Great White Hype.
That's right. That's right. A couple of the episodes were also directed by Trey Edward Schultz, who was the writer of Krisha, It Comes at Night, and Waves from 2019. Tanya Hamilton directed a few episodes. So yeah, none of these were even, I think like Adam McKay stayed on as producer, but largely got out of the way of the creative, which I think is interesting. So, you know, in conclusion, Pat, what did you think of the show, and is there anything else you want to talk about?
As somebody who loved this era of basketball, and still looks at it as maybe the best era of basketball we ever saw, it's still the predominant rivalry in the history of the NBA. This time period, these two teams. And again, it's more than just the games themselves. It's the personalities within the games. Mm-hmm. And to get the curtain peeled back a little bit and see a little bit more of it is always kind of a fun thing for the most part, because it gives you even a grander spectrum of what you're seeing on the court. And that, you know, the way they match up on the court isn't necessarily out of the realm of how they match up off the court, too, and these different things that happen. We didn't talk much about Adrian Brody, but I thought he was tremendous as Pat Riley.
And also, oh my god, his monologue or his speech where he gives everyone the business, and in the Laker locker room, and you see like, we respect you, Booker man.
Yeah,
it's so good.
And I'll say, like, initially when I found out he was playing Pat Riley, I go, Adrian, the pianist, what? And I was like in disbelief. But seeing him come to life as Pat Riley, I was eating a big plate of crow because I thought he was tremendous. I just, for whatever reason, had always envisioned Pat Riley being played by Michael Douglas, just based on the physical resemblance of
alone. I could see that. Unfortunately, Michael Douglas is currently 100. So
well, that's why it's not going to work. Gecko era Michael Douglas.
Like, yeah, sure. why are you wrecking this company? Because it's wreckable. That's why.
You know, the slick hair and the same note. Yeah. Like, I thought they would. But, hey, man, Adrian Brody was tremendous. And I think Pat Riley probably got the most fair portrayal of anybody in the show, to be honest, with his work with that team and what he achieved with that team. I didn't know that it had gotten canceled at the time it got canceled either. I was watching that seventh episode, which wound up being the series finale, and they do, you know, the end credit. What do you want to call it?
The chrono, I think, is the right term for it.
Yeah. And I'm like, wait, is this the end of the show? and then they talk about like 87, and I'm like, wait, this is the end of the show. What? Right. Oh, come on. Like,
you know, it was funny. Know, I didn't think we were getting a season two. So when Jason and I decided to do this originally, part of the appeal to me was one and done. As we all know, I can't commit to, besides the stuff I do with Jesse, I cannot commit to long runs on any of these shows anymore. the way my schedule is. So it was like, we're done here. And I remember complaining to Jason. I was like, I really wish we had gotten a little bit more of like the Lakers Celtics, because like the show's, the season's over and we've only had one NBA championship. Like, there was a whole era here. Like, what happened?
I was hoping it would either continue as like an anthology, or maybe it shifts to the Celtics of that time. And then maybe it shifts to the Bulls as they draft Jordan. And then maybe it shifts from there to when they build the Pistons and the Bad Boys. I just thought there was so much potential, and like to see it not realized is kind of sad.
I would love to see a dramatization of the Jordan era Bulls, because Jordan gets a lot of play, but you know who was also there? And I don't know if you remember him or not. He dabbled in wrestling a bit. Dennis Rodman. What a character.
I mean, he's there at the tail end of that era, but he's also on the Bad Boy Pistons. That's where he started. So
right. And I think it would be fun to see, to, as you said, peel back the curtain and see what was going on with the Bulls during that era. There's a lot of really fun basketball history that they could have dived into, but
that time frame, especially that, because again, we talked in the beginning, like, you know, everybody kind of assumes Michael Jordan was the savior of the NBA. No, it was Magic and Bird playing each other and building these teams, and the rivalry they put together that drew interest back to the NBA and got people excited about it again. Well, they came in 4 and 5 years before Michael Jordan did.
Well, you know, Pat, you know, you and I are boxing fans. And one of the things that Winning Time does, I talked about this with season one, but it bears repeating because it's a little bit of what they deal with in season two, is recognizing that sports isn't just sports. It's sports entertainment. And that if you put on a production, you know, I said this, Robert and I got kind of into a fist fight before the Ngannou Tyson Fury show. Well, you were there.
I'm glad somebody did because they didn't.
You heard us discussing, does boxing need spectacle? You know, does it need freak show fights and all of that? And the point that I was trying to get across, though it got somewhat muddled because Robert was a little, you know, off his tit, was that in order to get the... That's why I brought up wrestling, because it was, for me, it was a good model of this. In order to bring in the widest audience possible, you have to put on a big show that's going to appeal to a variety of people, not just sports enthusiasts. Because dad will go and watch the basketball game because dad likes basketball. But if you want to bring the wife and kids, you gotta, you know, you gotta have clowns and, you know, and things that they like. You have, you know, so like the Laker girls, you know, fireworks, musical acts, there's something there for everybody, and that's how you grow your audience. That was the point I was trying to make, and Winning Time deals with that, because like that doesn't exist before the Showtime era of the Lakers, and it's Buss that sort of sees basketball as an entertainment venue, not a sports competition strictly, recognizing that athletes are personalities. They're not just, you know, they're not just widgets in a machine. And that's also one, I think, one of the great strengths of the show, is that it definitely speaks to the value of presenting an entertainment product, not just a competitive product.
Yeah, I think it's well said. I think, and again, because this changed the league, the way things went. This right. is, you know, Jerry was a visionary in that respect. And eventually the rest of the league had to follow suit. It was kind of that old versus new clash, where the ownership styles of Jerry Buss and Red Auerbach were so, you know, different.
I was going to say,
and
look
Jerry
at the way
was seen as, you know, this kook, but Red was seen as, you know, Red knows what he's doing. And Red, that's why Red was the president of the association.
The reason why I brought up boxing was, like, you look at how, like, when we go back into the history of boxing, just look at, like, the HBO show, boxing era, you know, the George Foreman stuff, and how it's a little drab. You know, it's a hallway and a ring, and they walk out, and, you know, there's not a whole lot going on there. Look at PBC now. I mean, you know, the fucking Tyson Fury and Francis Ngannou was a slight over the top. But, you know, the average PBC fight looks like a wrestling event. They don't even have the cornermen walk out with them anymore.
No.
Because nobody walks out with wrestlers. You know, when Steve Austin and The Rock would come to the ring for WrestleMania, they walked out alone. And that's what people like. That's what, you know, I mean, even like the UFC used to not do that, but you know who was doing it at the time? Bellator. Bellator and Strikeforce had guys coming out by themselves and, you know, would do that walk alone. I can still remember King Mo just dancing on his way to the ring.
Also because they had smaller arenas. where they couldn't have four people in an aisleway that would fit.
It's fair. It was a very tight hallway. but we're cracking wise, but what I'm saying is there's something to be said for pageantry. And pageantry is what brings in the non-sports fans. I'll tell you, and I talked about like my ex who would watch some of this stuff with me, and she would always be drawn in by the extra, you know, not by the competition in and of itself. And I'm the exact same way because anytime that I've watched football, I don't watch the average football game, but I love the Super Bowl. And boy, is the Super Bowl full of pageantry. There's all kinds of stuff going on in football. And you know, when you get to the Super Bowl.
And you know, you got my side of the audience where I could give a shit less about the halftime show. Mm-hmm. I want to watch a good game, you know, depending on who is the halftime show. But I also don't want it to take an hour because I want to get back to the game. I want to see the, you know, I'm there for the steak. Some people are there for the sizzle, and, you know, that's right. Okay. But you're not going to get an audience of both unless you have both.
Right. Well said. All right. If there's nothing else, then that is our review of Winning Time. Yes?
Yes.
All right. Well, I want to thank Pat for hanging out with me tonight. I very much enjoyed the show and I enjoyed the conversation. I don't even know when you're back, Pat. We just threw this on the schedule right quick. Let's see. When are you back again?
PM4. It's a good question. I don't even know when I'm back.
Yeah, our boxing schedule is way the fuck off. Okay. December 28th. So you'll be back in almost 2 months for the Barrera Morales trilogy. The third time we're going to try this, by the way.
Third time's a charm, everybody.
And then we'll see you again shortly in January after that. We're going to do a triple feature focusing on the Punisher movies. The Dolph Lundgren one, the Thomas Jane one, and then Punisher Warzone with Ray Stevens.
Ray Stevenson, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to that. And I'm sure you'll pop up here and there and do something. Why don't you and Ronnie record anymore? You did the one Tulsa King back in January or February and then never again.
We were going to do during back to school, we were going to do a feature on back to school movies. We were going to do The Substitute, The Principal, and Dangerous Minds, but the scheduling just kind of fell through, unfortunately. But, I'm up for some stuff every now and then, depending on what it looks like. Ronnie is too, but, you know, we don't run the network. We're just, you know, we're just the soldiers.
Uh-huh. You were given autonomy. You don't have to wait for me to give you orders.
No, I'm a team player, coach. I fit in the system.
Okay. We'll talk later then, Magic. All right. In any case, speaking of Magic, myself and Sean Comer looked at the Red Curtain trilogy earlier today, which is Strictly Ballroom, which was amazing. Romeo and Juliet and Moulin Rouge. Alexis took over the reins of Damn You Hollywood this past week while I was off singing karaoke. And Robert, and Dorian reviewed Five Nights at Freddy's. Myself and Jesse Starcher had ourselves a good 2-hour conversation about The Deuce Season 2. Next week, no Damn You Hollywood. However, Evan Bevins will be on Comic Strip. We'll be talking Two Guns, the book and the movie, and then the Middlehammer of Doom Jukebox. We're going to be reviewing Poppy and telling fun stories and all that. Alexis Haina will have somebody he's dragging into this. She'll be reviewing Gen V,
series loose.
Yeah, the boys side show, whatever the hell it's called. This weekend we've got an old commentary track that we did for Monty Python on the Holy Grail, and then Metal Hammer of Doom Sundays is Woods of Ypres, Woods 5 Part 2 that Robert Cooper and Jesse did. Plus I will be on Source Material this Monday coming up. We'll be looking at Elvira Meets Vincent Price. That's a canned show. We already did that one, and boy, did we have fun. Elvira, right?
You can't not have fun with Elvira or Vincent Price, so.
They don't make them like Elvira anymore. Not a single personality.
Do you know that the Muppet Show, remember they used to have Vincent Twice?
Vaguely, yeah.
Yeah, so I was like 2 the first time I saw that, and I was terrified of Vincent Twice, Vincent Twice, the puppet. More so than I was terrified of the actual person, Vincent Price.
Yeah, Vincent Price I knew from like the Michael Jackson Thriller video and some, you know, and he was Egghead in the Batman show.
Scooby-Doo cartoon.
Right. But he had this like, you know, because again, a child of the 80s, you're 7 to 10 years behind me. And so by that point, you know, a lot of Vincent Price stuff was just about done. He was kind of doing a project here or there. But the bulk of his career had existed well before either one of us was born. And what a career. Like Bela Lugosi, what a career this guy had. Yeah. Like, he did everything.
Oh, man. The Abominable Dr. Fives is like one of my favorites. Like, he did so much great stuff, but you're not aware of it because, you know, I'm watching him with Scooby, Scrappy, Daphne, and Flim Flam try to put 13 ghouls back into this box.
Yeah, I'm watching him with a, you know, with a tilted camera on the Batman 60s show as they're doing the Batusi. And he's got the
corona. Egghead.
All right. Hey, Pat, you're recording with you doing any wrestling? Recording with Gavin anytime soon? Any casual hero talk? Any
bunkhouse brawl? Casual heroes.
All right. Thanks for coming on again. We'll talk to you soon. For Pat Mullen, I'm Mark Rattledge. Be well, be safe, and behave.